Robert Stark. I am joined here with Dana Countryman. He is a musician and he has a new album out called Girlville. Dana, great having you on the show.
Hey, thanks, Robert. I appreciate it. I'm excited about being on your show. This is great.
And I'm also joined here with Pill Eater and Adventure Kid.
What's up?
Hey. How's you guys doing?
Hey there. Nice to talk to you all.
Your new album, Girlville, this just came out, and this is inspired by early 1960s music, and you've done a lot of work in kind of that genre, but can you talk about the inspiration for your most recent album?
Well, this is an album that I had wanted to do for about 30 years, actually. And about 1980, I kind of stumbled into this early era of pre-Beatles girl group music, like the Chiffons and the Crystals and the Shangri-Las. And I really didn't know much about that whole era. I missed the whole thing because I was a kid of the 70s. And so it was kind of like rediscovering past culture, basically. And I just thought it was a really cute, charming time, kind of an innocent time of, singing. The girls were singing songs about, going to the chapel and let's get married. And, they didn't have a whole lot of societal pressures. There were no protests in the streets or, burning American flags or anything like that in the early 60s. I'm talking about around 62 to 64. And the Vietnam War was just about to start, but there was a little rest period right in there. In fact, a lot of people say the 60s didn't start until about 1965, and it was still kind of a holdover from the 50s up until that stage. But this is just a style of music that I just really liked, and I thought I would like to try and write my own songs in that style. And fortunately, over the years, I have met a lot of really talented female singers, so I enlisted them to be part of this project, and it came to life. It came out last January, actually.
So these are three female singers. Most of your previous work, has it been you doing the vocals?
Yeah, my previous three albums were solo albums, and I sang most of the vocals on those. I occasionally would have a duet with couple different people on my projects, but it was mostly me. This one actually has, 9 separate female lead singers. And I don't sing lead on any of these songs. I do chime in a little bit of background vocals here and there, but it's pretty much in the background. And it was really super fun. I admired quite a few of these singers for years, people that I had never met, like Lisa Michaels and Andrea Perry, for example. I've been a fan of theirs, but I'd never had gotten to work with them until this project.
It's interesting. You had that one album, Moog-tastic. This might sound interesting. I love synthesizers and electronic music, and I know this might sound cheesy, but ever since I was 15 years old, all I wanted was a little fatty Moog synthesizer. But 10 years later, I think you could get them relatively cheap or something, But recently, Moog did a reissue of the Mini Moog Model D, but unfortunately, it goes for $3,700. So yeah. I'm looking at my VST racks in Reason, because Reason can run VSTs now. And the only substitute I can get is the Arturia Mini Moog VST of Digital. So, you know, it's like that's funny. And so I always think, what is your background or interest in Moog synthesizers? And do you have a preference of them? And do you have a fascination love for it?
Well, actually, I got really interested in synthesizers when I was in high school. This is back in the 70s. And there was a local middle school that actually had a Moog synthesizer, a Moog console, the Moog 15, which are like three portable cabinets. And I actually got to mess around on it, and it was a big thrill for me back in the day. I remember my sister, of course I was in high school, I remember my sister telling me, you know, Dana, you're never going to get a Moog synthesizer. They're like $10,000, you know. But years later, I was able to piece together, module by module, my dream machine. And I actually have sitting behind me. In fact, I might be able to turn the video on to this thing. I actually have a modular synthesizer. Can you see that?
Hold on. Oh, I see it. Cool.
Yeah, and so I was able to put that together over a course of about 3 or 4 years. And my wife would ask me, you know, what do you want for Father's Day or what do you want for your birthday? Another module, please. And so little by little, I put it together. And I did record that Moogtastic album in 2010. And prior to that, I did two albums with Jean-Jacques Perret, who is a legendary French electronic music pioneer. And I was a big fan of his when I was in high school, and little did I know that years later I'd become friends with him, and we'd get to record and do some touring together, both in Europe and also in America.
I heard that Jean-Jacques Perret was considered to be the founder of the techno genre. He was called the godfather of techno by The Guardian.
Yep, he was actually doing electronic music in 1952. That was before the synthesizer was invented. Generally became available around 1966, 67. But he was using a very early French synthesizer called an Ondulene. And it was actually vacuum tube powered. It kind of looked like an old radio with a keyboard on top of it. And it could create some really amazing sounds. And so he was able to use that back in France, and then he brought it to America and recorded some albums for Vanguard Records in the early 60s. Eventually, he became one of the main guys, one of the first guys to use the Moog synthesizer. He actually had the second Moog that was offered for sale, and he and his partner Gershon Kingsley recorded two really landmark albums of popular electronic music, not so much the esoteric avant-garde stuff. This was actually very melodic, almost little kid-like in the style of the melodies, and the sounds were funny, and you know, he's got quite a cult following. So I'm very honored to have gotten to become friends and to write and record with him.
Oh yeah, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Do you think retro music is making a comeback, Mr. Countryman?
I think so. There's an underground movement of kind of retro pop, you know, it's like this whole power pop movement. There's a lot of young guys and some older guys too, writing kind of melodic pop, as an alternative to alternative rock. And I think it's great. I like melody, and I like some of the new alternative stuff too, but it's kind of refreshing to see guys in their 20s in these bands that, you know, are doing the more poppy, melodic, catchy stuff. So, yeah, there's definitely a movement of that happening, and it's pretty active on Facebook. There's a lot of power pop Facebook groups, and I'm kind of in a lot of those. And yeah, there's some neat radio shows that are purely melodic pop, and some of that is retro, and some from the newer bands and newer artists too. So, if there's a melody, I like it. I'm a big melody person.
Yeah, well, you know, to me, I consider you to be kind of a hero because you brought music, what some people consider to be outsider music, to the mainstream. You brought bands that people hadn't really thought about like the Residents and Shuby Taylor and guys like that to the mainstream, with your magazine, Cool and Strange Music Magazine, when it was still running.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I did the magazine between 1996 and 2003. And I sold it to a gentleman who unfortunately never continued with it. And that's about the time that I started doing the electronic music. But it was a lot of fun and a lot of work. I never worked so hard in my life as when I worked on the magazine. I was working a regular job and then doing the magazine at the same time, so I was working two jobs. But I got to work with a lot of great artists, cover artists and writers and reviewers, and tons of CDs came in for review from a lot of different record companies. You know, we got to interview some famous people for the magazine. And it was a very rewarding time. I made a ton of friends because of the magazine. And ultimately, that led to my friendship with Jean-Jacques Perret, as a matter of fact.
You wrote a biography about a Jean-Jacques Perret passport to the future.
Yes.
What I know so is interesting about that is for that, you interviewed the Twin Peaks composer Angelo Badalamenti, and I'm a big fan of his work and the show Twin Peaks. Did mm-hmm. you meet him through Jean-Jacques Perret?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, he and Jean-Jacques were friends back in the early 60s, and Angelo used to use the name Andy Bedale, and before everybody used their ethnic names, you know, and he used to basically kind of produce some of Jean-Jacques' albums for Vanguard Records. So they had worked together back in the 60s, and then eventually Jean-Jacques moved back to France, and they still maintained their friendship. And I actually got to have dinner with Angelo in 2008, and I got to interview him and talk to him at length about, you know, his work with Jean-Jacques mainly. So, yeah, he's a really cool guy. I just heard from him a couple weeks ago, as a matter of fact.
You know, it's interesting. When I first heard about Perret, was some time ago. It was like, I think it might have been 10 years ago, when the internet was getting big, and there was this internet memes on the internet, and there was this one internet meme called Cat on a Keyboard in Space, and it shows a picture of space with like this cat on like a, I think an ARP Odyssey synthesizer, and it plays a song by him. I think the song is Brazilian Flower, and it goes,
yeah.
And it's kind of really goofy, and yep. I associated that song with that joke on the internet.
Yeah,
until I went into it, and are you aware of this internet joke, Cat on the Keyboard in Space?
Yeah, I do remember seeing that some time ago. Yeah, the thing about Jean-Jacques' music is a lot of it has been used in commercials, from as far back as the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, something else about his music. It's been used for a lot of things over the years. It's been on The Simpsons, and Jean-Jacques and I actually had a song that we did together that was on South Park. South Park, yeah.
Oh, that was the one, Chicken on the Rocks. For
correct.
The one where they were jumping around on those giant testicles.
Exactly. It's a pretty bizarre plot, you know. So that was pretty cool. And then Jean-Jacques himself, co-wrote the music to Disneyland's Main Street Electrical Parade. And that's a nighttime.
I remember seeing that when I was a little kid, but I think they may have revived it, but the last time I saw it was probably like the early 90s. I think when did that originally start?
So 1972 it started. They take it away and then they bring it back from time to time. And it's very popular, so when they bring it back, there's a big fanfare and a lot of publicity, and then they retire it, and then they bring it back again whenever they want to bring the crowds back. So it's a very magical theme.
With South Park, how did the creators, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, did they contact you to write that?
Well, actually, I got a phone call from one of their producers. And I just happened to be home that day, and they said they'd heard a YouTube video with that theme in it. And they said, we want to use that tune on the show in 2 days. And I said, well, we have a record company, so maybe you should call them and see what you guys can work out. And they were able to work out the details to make that happen. So 2 days later, it was on the show. But no, it wasn't actually written for South Park. It was already been on an album. The album is called The Happy Electropop Music Machine. Yeah. And we recorded that. Jean-Jacques and I recorded that in Paris, actually. That was the first thing we ever recorded together.
So you were you picturing giant balls when you were writing that, or no?
No, not at all. I mean, it's about, it's got, bird sounds on it, chickens and baby chicks and things like that. It's just supposed to be a goofy little, it's a musical wink to Turkey in the Straw, which is an American folk song. It's kind of like a jazzed up version of that. But no, we were just trying to have fun with it and be kind of goofy. And I guess they heard the song and thought it would work for their show. It was kind of cool because they actually made it into a ringtone after that South Park appearance. And I guess people have it on their phones, so that's kind of neat.
You had a band back in the 80s called Amazing Pink, and you performed on the Late Night Show. This was also a kind of a 50s to early 60s sound.
Well, the name of the band was the Amazing Pink Things, and it actually was a comedy vocal group. And we did a lot of different styles. We didn't just do one style. We did funny songs in harmony. That was our bag. And it was an early version of the Arsenio Hall show. And so we got to be on that show. And we were performing in Hollywood at the time. And they brought us over to the studio. And, we got to do that show. It was pretty fun. It was very fun and very exciting for us. But it wasn't really a 50s group per se. It was really a vocal group that did a lot of different styles.
So with your music background, you originally got started, you did a Beatles cover band as a kid.
Yep. I was a teenager. I think I was 19. I moved back to the Detroit, Michigan area and started the first band I was ever in with one of my best friends. And, we weren't real successful, but we had a lot of fun. We played a couple gigs, and it was a learning experience. It was the first time I ever worked with other musicians, and, it has its ups and downs when you have your personality conflicts and, people can't agree on rehearsal times or which songs you're going to do. But we all agreed on the Beatles, and it was a lot of fun. But it was one of those early kind of experimental things in a way. It kind of fell apart like 6 months later, and then I went on to other musical projects.
Yeah, Jack. Oh, yeah. What is your musical taste? Because after looking at your magazine, you seem to like everything from girl pop groups to harsh experimental music like The Residents.
Yeah, with the magazine, we tried to cover it all. As long as it was cool or strange, it basically would fit into the magazine. However, people would send me CDs of like folk music or jazz. And I mean, I like some of that, but I just didn't think that was unique enough to really be featured in the magazine. So, we did, bands like The Residents or the legendary Stardust Cowboy, Wildman Fisher, things that were kind of edgy. And then we would do like surf music, which is like Dick Dale or Davy Allen, somebody like that, to Mrs. Miller.
Some of your recent album, Grillville, influenced by the 60s surf music?
Not really surf music, although I do like surf music.
Are you talking about the Beach Boys specifically?
Well, not so much for that. For the magazine, we covered instrumental surf, so it wasn't really vocal, what later became, the Beach Boys took over the whole surf genre, but originally it was guitar music and, drums and bass. And there's a lot of those instrumental bands that are still around. And back in the late 90s, early 2000s, there were quite a few instrumental surf bands. So we featured quite a few of those. We had a couple of interviews with some of those bands in the magazine. But basically it was we tried to cover the subjects and the bands and singers that most of the major music publications wouldn't cover. Like, they would be too weird for most of the mainstream magazines like Rolling Stone or, you know, Pulse or things like that.
Did you ever cover trucker music?
No, but I think we did cover CB records real briefly. Yeah.
Wow, that's so cool.
we didn't really cover country music per se, but there are some artists that kind of like touched on the edges of country music, particularly if it was kind of irreverent or, you know, naughty or something like that.
And a lot of your work is comedy themed.
I love comedy, and it was really fun when I was in that comedy vocal group, the Amazing Pink Things, because we got to do a double whammy of not just, you know, good harmony, but also funny songs. So it was kind of very rewarding to do shows for audiences and make them laugh and also do it, you know, in a professional style that was very well rehearsed. There's some videos floating around on YouTube of the Amazing Pink Things performances, just a few.
Your recent album, Grillville, has an interesting album cover, and I noticed the style do kind of go together. Do you design them, or do you have an artist who does them?
I have an artist. I actually did start out as a cartoonist before I got into music, and I kind of veered away from doing the actual illustration, but I always act as the art director on my album projects. So I actually designed the album, and then I had an actual artist that I've used many times named Paul Fricke. He basically took my ideas and turned them into something that looked good. So it's always a collaboration. You know, when I did the magazine, I worked with a lot of different illustrators for the cover and illustrations on the inside of the magazine. And I like working with artists, particularly nice people that are easy to work with and can follow direction without getting, you know, upset, that kind of thing.
With the songs on your new album, Grillville, I mean, one of them is about George Harrison. What are some of the different inspirations for the songs?
Well, the reason why I wrote the song I'm in Love with George Harrison is because there were a lot of Beatles, there were a lot of girl group records about the Beatles. Now, none of them really became popular.
But you were saying earlier this was based on music prior to the Beatles.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably one of the later one of the later years. That would be from about 64, because the Beatles really hit America in early 64. The other ones kind of tend to run a little bit earlier, like 61, 62. They're written in that style of Phil Spector or the Ronettes and the Angels and a lot of those types of girl groups. So I listened to a lot of that kind of music when I was researching those styles. And then I would try and write my own song with kind of the same feel without copying the words and music, that is. I was very careful about that. And the same thing with the arrangements, bringing in strings and tambourines and castanets and all the kinds of instrumentation that they used on those early girl group records. So I really tried to recreate that sound. And it was a challenge. But I'm really happy with the way it came out. The best part for me was actually working with the lady singers, because I picked female singers who could recreate that kind of innocence, that kind of, they almost sound like teenagers, but there wasn't a single woman that sang on this album that was younger than 50. But you wouldn't know it to listen to the album, though. They sound very young.
Yeah, well, your music, it kind of reminds me of, let's see, what band am I thinking of? Well, some French group that used to do like this band in the 90s, they used to do like this type of retro style music.
Mm-hmm.
They were this French group, and their music was influenced by like 60s girl pop, French 60s girl pop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a singer named April March. I think she's from France. She was popular for a little while there. Yeah, and there's some other bands too. There's a band called The School that's out of England, and they do kind of classic girl group style original music very centered on the early 60s. I like those other groups, you know, that have tried to do this, but I just wanted to do my own spin on it. And I wanted to do it, you know, the way that I kind of heard it in my head. I did collaborate on a few of these songs with a really good friend of mine named Frank Young. And we worked on four of these songs together. But there's 19 songs in total, and most of them I wrote by myself.
There's a book from Feral House Publishing called Yee Yee Girls about the early 60s French girl pop. Are you familiar with that book?
I am not familiar with the book. There are a couple other books about girl groups that came out earlier than that. But I am familiar with that Yee Yee style of French girl pop. I didn't really try and represent that with this album, though. This is very much American style, early 60s pop.
Are you a fan of Stereolab?
I love Stereolab. Yeah. I like Stereolab.
It's the group I was talking about.
Right, that was the group you were talking about. I saw Stereolab, that was 9 years ago. I was young. I saw them in Philadelphia, and I was very... They haven't came back, and... their music is fantastic, and I think I found out that through them for the original, there was a Moog documentary back then. In the soundtrack, they contribute a song about the Moog synthesizer, and I just loved it.
Yeah, no, they're great. They're great. I've got a couple of their albums.
I love Emperor Tomato Ketchup. That's a great album.
Well, I had Dots and Loops. That was the album. I saw them during a later period, post after that, but... yeah, they're nice mix of that French pop and, you know, Moog synthesizing stuff. That's what really got me into synthesizers. Mm-hmm. This is interesting, too, but have you ever met Morton Sabotnik?
I have never met him. Is he still around? I can't remember.
There's a documentary being made of him on GoFundMe, and I don't know if you might have met him or something.
Nope.
But,
interesting. I never met him. I met quite a few other people, but I haven't met him. Nope.
Well, have you met the B-52s? Because their music is kind of similar to the Amazing Pink.
Yeah, no, I never did meet them, but I do like some of their songs, yeah.
You had a song, Jealous Heart, which came out in 2014. Were you kind of going for the same genre?
You know, with that song, I was trying to write something kind of in the style of, you know, the band Fountains of Wayne.
I've heard of them.
Oh yeah, I've heard that. Stacey's Mom.
Stacey's
Mom. That was their big song, and I kind of wanted to write a song in that kind of rhythm, you know, without, you know, copying their songs. So that was a definite effort to write in that kind of punky pop kind of style. I used one of my favorite guitarists, who is a much better guitarist than I am. His name is Chad Quist. And, yeah, that was a lot of fun. There's actually a music video floating around on YouTube for that Jealous Heart song of mine.
And then you had the song Baby, I'll Be Your Star. Was that part of the same album?
Yeah, that's on the same album. I think that's on my Pop 2 album, I believe. I think the album starts with that track. That was a fun one. That was an old song of mine that I had never really finished properly. So when it came time to work on the album, I completely rewrote the lyrics. And it talks about reality TV shows and things, you know, that are more current than when I originally started the song. One of my things I like to do is finish things I started years and years ago. I'm into really tying up loose ends. And, so on every album that I do, even on this girl group album, on Girlville, there's a song called Love Till the End of Time. And I actually wrote that around 1979, not knowing what I would ever do with it. And then when it came time to work on this album, I was writing new songs. And I remembered that one. And I thought, oh, I could go back and do a better version of that. So I added it to this project. So. My thing is, I like to do oddball styles. I like to do styles that basically aren't popular. And because I just like that style, and it's a challenge for me. You know, I grew up in the 70s, basically, late 60s, early 70s. That was kind of my era. And I've done other styles, you know, jazz and things like that over the years. But I'm really enjoying working on this kind of what I call retro pop. And as a matter of fact,
what you do next, your next project should be like a Frank Zappa style project where you make like an experimental jazz album.
Well, I like Zappa. I admire Zappa a lot. He was a brilliant guy. I actually saw him in concert once. But my next album is actually a collaboration with another producer, singer who lives in upstate New York. His name is Matt Tyson. And he and I have both written 7 songs in kind of a early 60s Beach Boys / Beatles / Four Seasons / doo-wop. Like it's kind of a mishmash of a lot of different styles, even a little bit of Everly Brothers, a little bit of Righteous Brothers. And he's a really great vocalist, so it's been a real fun project. That's coming out in September, actually.
Does retro pop refer specifically to a 60s revival or just anything that revives a past genre?
To me, it's anything that revives, you know, a past style of music. I mean, it could be the 40s music, which I also like. I was in a 40s band for several years. But right now, for me, retro pop kind of means 60s and early 70s style, you know, pre-disco. And then as early as the 1950s doo-wop era. There's a doo-wop song on this album, as a matter of fact. I just like writing in those styles, and it's a challenge for me, and I like to recreate the sound of the past. It's fun for me.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, because I got a friend who has this album, and he's trying to recreate the sound of 80s new wave.
Well, isn't that what new retro wave is?
Yeah,
interesting. Well, yeah, people have done that, and I think everything comes around again. You know, like it's kind of like fashion. You know, like I used to wear Hawaiian shirts. Like, if you can see this, I'm wearing a Hawaiian shirt. Back in the 70s, I started going to thrift shops, and nobody was wearing Hawaiian shirts, and people used to make fun of me. Like, dude, what are you wearing a Hawaiian shirt for? Now I get these young guys coming up, you know, high-fiving me, going, cool shirt, dude, you know? So it all just kind of comes around again if you wait long enough.
Hawaiian shirts, I think they're originally popular in the early 60s. Was there another revival in the 80s? Because I've seen them. Maybe it was in some film, like, or early 90s, like, was it like Captain Ron? Were they kind of more making fun of it?
Actually, you know, it goes back way before that. It goes back to, like, the 20s. There was a Hawaiian craze back in the 1920s and the early 30s. And so, you know, it's like everything. There's waves of popularity. But, yeah. I have a lot of Hawaiian shirts.
What do you think about the early 60s surf music that uses the influence that's influenced by Hawaiian music?
Well, I love Hawaiian music. I've been to Hawaii a couple times, and there's something really peaceful about, you know, the Hawaiian style. It's kind of a mishmash of Polynesian, and they kind of have their own culture. You know, in Hawaii, they have their own charts. It's the only state that I know of in the United States that has their own native style of music. You know, like in Memphis or New Orleans, they've got their own style in one city, but it doesn't encompass the entire state. So Hawaii is really unusual in that respect. And of course, they have top 40 radio, you know, Justin Timberlake or whatever, you know, all that stuff they play over there too. But I like the uniqueness of that style of kind of mellow singing. The guys would sing in falsetto, and a lot of times they wouldn't really have women in their bands. They would have a guy singing in kind of a woman's voice, and it has a really unique quality to it. It's kind of haunting to me.
Yeah, you mentioned one time I was talking to you on Facebook, you mentioned you like Exotica, you know, like Sumac and Martin Denny.
Yeah. I actually got to interview Martin Denny for the magazine, and that was a big thrill for me. I love Exotica, you know, which is kind of a jungle jazz style. That's how I would describe it. It kind of has easy listening jazz with a lot of jungle rhythms, you know, lots of unusual jungle percussion and sometimes the sounds of birds and other animals kind of mixed in. It's really unique. And that was popular in the early 50s, pre-rock and roll.
There's this might sound interesting, but I was thinking that we're talking about revivals and how we have these fashion comes about, like about Hawaiian shirts and certain genres of music. It's interesting in the electronic music industry, especially, you know, when NAMM comes once a year and all the big corporations shows off their instruments. In the past 10 years, there's been this kind of analog revival scene where things were all digital in the 90s. And all of a sudden, for the first time, you're seeing very somewhat affordable to expensive analog synthesizers where you could say, I know Korg did a reissue of the MS-20 and now the MS-20 Mini. And I love that little synthesizer. I made an album on that myself. But you're also seeing, you know, Moog just reissued the Mini Model D, but that's like $3,000. You also see, like, there's this competition, or you'll just see basically, I think Korg also reissued the ARP, too. They just decided to get the ARP and got the license from them, and it looks like a replica. And you see now that there's this, this even now the Japanese company, Roland, their iconic Roland TB-303, just a few months ago, they released the TB-03 and TR-09 digital. They look alike, it sounds alike, and, in the next coming months, I think they're going to do the TR-808 and the SH-101. And so there's this whole market based upon selling the past. And do you have thoughts about that? And do you think it's kind of expensive? Do you think it's a market fad? I mean, is it better to stick music making on a computer if you could use Reason? Or what's this ideal about people getting into hardware again? Is it just a certain class who can afford it?
Well, that's a good question. I actually use both digital and analog. In 2003, when I sold the magazine, I started putting together that synthesizer back there. So that's an analog synth. It has separate modules. There's no digital technology, except for the actual circuitry does use integrated circuits as opposed to transistors. Back in the day, they were actually hand soldering transistors in there. It was, you know, pre-integrated circuits. But the sound of it sounds very analog, and it's designed to sound analog and interact with all the other modules in an analog way with patch cords that you have to physically put in. However, saying that, even though I do own analog equipment, I also have digital equipment. I've got, you know, a classic DX7, Yamaha DX7, and several other Korg keyboards. So I just use whatever sound I hear in my head, I'll use it, whether it's digital or analog, whatever it takes to create that sound. You know, there are some purists that would be horrified to, you know, I like to use Reason, as a matter of fact. I've used Reason quite a bit. And you can make it sound very analog if you're really careful. I don't really like things to sound really super processed or too quantized, too MIDI-fied. I like it to sound kind of organic and natural sounding. You know, I really got into the whole analog synth. I even built some of my own modules and silk screened the front sub of them. I hand built quite a few of them. And I have a project coming up that I actually built my own synthesizer, which I haven't debuted yet to the world, but it's coming up in one of my next couple of projects. So, I mean, it's cool. There's a lot of guys out there that are doing electronic music, and some of them are...
Your new synthesizer you're building, is that for mass production or more for a novelty?
Well, it's just a prototype, and it's not for mass production at this stage. However, once I do debut it, I'll do a whole video demonstrating how it works. And hey, if some company wants to hook up with me and try and mass produce it, I'm not going to mortgage our house or anything like that to try and do it. But just talking a little bit about synthesizer collectors, there are a lot of guys who really aren't musicians, but they want to do electronic music. So there's a lot of what you call self-running patches, like sequencer stuff, which is kind of like Tangerine Dream, which was a band back in the the early 80s, really, that kind of did this.
Like movie soundtracks, mostly.
Yeah, a lot of those. That's a certain style of synthesizer music. And there's a lot of those guys that don't have keyboards, and they don't really consider themselves musicians, but they do love music. And that's the way they can express themselves, is by creating that. And also what they call bug music or aleatory. It's kind of noise. There's noise bands.
Yeah.
Well, there's noise synthesizer groups. A lot of times it's just one guy.
Exactly.
And just to make a lot of weird squiggly noises and kind of science fiction sounds.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because there was this, in the punk rock world back in the 70s and the 80s, you had people like Daniel Miller and Steve Albini, who really weren't musicians per se, but they used the synthesizer to make like this jagged, like, yeah, scary.
Well, I was thinking Suicide. That's one of those classics.
Mm-hmm. And they made this scary sounding music with the synthesizer.
Well, even like punk rock, I mean, the Sex Pistols, I don't think they considered themselves musicians. It was really more of an experimental kind of bastardization of rock and roll, you know. So there's always people that like to push the limits of pop music, and they can either piss people off or make them incredibly happy, just depending on, you know, what you like, you know.
How would people have generally described your genre of work?
Well, I think right now the main thing I'm doing, I'm not doing electronic music too much, to tell you the truth. I'm really centering on early American pop music. I'm talking like, you know, after Elvis, before the Beatles. That's kind of the period that I'm personally into. So I would call it retro pop, you know, and it's very retroactive in that style. There's a lot of people who are doing kind of Beach Boys-esque stuff, like the band Explorers Club. And, you know, they've had a lot of their songs used on TV shows and movie soundtracks and things like that. So I think there's a renaissance of rediscovering the past. You know, like I went to see Brian Wilson about 6 months ago when he came with his band to play in Seattle. And, you know, the place was packed, and it wasn't just old guys. There were a lot of young people there, too. I think people like rediscovering styles that didn't necessarily just happened when they graduated from high school. You know, there's a whole different world that existed before that.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because to me, you're kind of like a modern-day Van Dyke Parks. I don't know if you know who that is.
Oh, yeah, I know who he is.
The guy who rediscovered, like, this old 1800s music, like show tunes and
sea shanties
and made it into songs.
Right. Same thing with Randy Newman. He has a songwriting style that goes back to the early 1900s, to like vaudeville days, really. A lot of his stuff, he's very talented, runs the gamut of all the decades. You know, he's done spoofs of, we mentioned punk rock and new wave and hip hop. And so, and then guys like Weird Al Yankovic, who, you know, are still out there recording, doing parodies of modern hip hop. Yeah. Yeah, he's done like parodies of country music and Zappa. He does a great parody of Zappa, by the way. And the Beach Boys, he does a brilliant parody of Beach Boys. By the way, I got to meet him twice, and he's like the nicest guy ever. Just very down to earth.
Yeah, he doesn't even curse in his music, which I find kind of weird.
Pretty unique. Yeah. The first time I met him, he came to one of our shows. When I was in that band, The Amazing Pink Things, we played in Hollywood, and he came to one of our shows. We actually did one of his songs in our show that he'd written as kind of a country music parody, but we did it we changed it to kind of a 50s doo-wop parody. So we got to meet him and hang out with him a little bit after the show. And the second time I met him, I knew his drummer. So he got us backstage passes, and my son was about 7 years old at the time. And we had a picture taken with Weird Al and my son and my wife and myself. And somehow I lost the picture. I remember my son telling his friends at school that I met Weird Al Yankovic. He'd be like, oh, no, you didn't. And I couldn't find the picture for years. And finally, I came across it. So he was able to go to school, you know, with bragging rights, you know, that he met a celebrity. But, you know, I really admire people that have versatile talent. They can do a lot of different styles, and that's why I like working with this guy Matt Tyson right now, because he's very self-contained. He has a home studio like I do, and he's able to kind of morph into whatever style, you know, he wants to. So yeah, I like challenges, you know, but I only do the styles that I like. I don't really do styles of music that I'm not in love with.
Yeah. Are there any genres of music that you just flat out don't like?
Don't like?
Yeah, that you don't like.
Well, I'm not crazy about most of the hip hop stuff, the rap stuff, unless there's singing in it. As soon as it goes to like a vocal part, then my ears perk up. But if it's just talking, just rapping, to me that's kind of monotonous, you know. And I don't like the anger aspect. I'm a pretty happy person, so I like music that's happy, and that's what you'll hear in a lot of the stuff, like all this girl group stuff. I don't think there's mainly only one song that's kind of about breaking up, but everything else is very positive. And but I like to do music that makes me feel good, and if it makes other people feel good, then that makes me really happy.
There's a band I really like, and we had him on the podcast, Ronnie Martin of Joy Electric. Joy Electric is just a one-man project, and he just uses Moog synthesizers. You've heard of them?
I have, and we reviewed a couple of his CDs back in the day. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. He's actually a pastor at a church. We had him on a couple of months back. His last album was 4 years ago, but I love his albums to death. I listen to everything by Ronnie Martin, but he just sticks with a synthesizer and pretty much in his Christian faith is just super happy and stuff like that. You know, if you have listened to his classic albums in the mid-90s, I probably can add to the vibe.
All right, I've got a couple floating around here somewhere. Yeah, I've got a pretty big record collection. I've got, I don't know if you can see this video or not, but I've got about 7,000 LPs. There's another over there. And I've got hundreds of CDs and MP3s by the thousands. So I have a pretty big collection of personal music. And now I can go on the internet and just go to YouTube and find pretty much whatever I want, you know. So that's really great. It's like an encyclopedia of sound.
Small record collection I'm looking at in the bottom of my bookcase or room. I just get my favorite albums on LP. Latest album I was playing in my living room was Talk Talk Spirit of Eden. And I think I was playing Depeche Mode's Spirit album again for some reason. those are the albums being floated around in vinyl collection. But my vinyl collection is small. I'll just pick my all-time favorite albums and get them on vinyl if I really like, you know, or just try them out.
Right.
Yeah, and I listen to, I don't really have a record collection. I sold it back in the day. I listen to stuff on a computer. I like to listen to progressive rock like Captain Beefheart and the weird stuff like that.
I have Yes. I love Yes's stuff, you know, especially Fragile. I like that album. I think it was very folky, kind of.
That's a great album. That's a great album.
Yeah, absolutely. Love them.
Do you like Captain Beefheart?
Well, I don't really like Captain Beefheart, I have to admit. It's a little too out there. My tastes run a little bit more on the poppy side. So that's what you kind of will hear if you listen to my stuff. I haven't really done a whole lot of the experimental type of music.
I just have one more thought. What are your thoughts upon the Eurorack synthesizer and that people are buying expensive?
Well, I'm an old dude, so I like the old style. You know, I mean, when I was a teenager, I was just in love with the Moog synthesizer. I used to draw pictures of it in my notebook and in school. There wouldn't be like one single page of paper that was hadn't been doodled on, you know, without synthesizer drawings on it. So I like the what we call the 5U style, which is, you know, about 8 inches tall. I have had a few of the Eurorack modules, which are about 4 inches or 5 inches tall. And no, I guess they're about 3.5 to 4 inches tall. But I've actually taken those modules and morphed them into the full size module so they'll fit in that crazy thing back there. So some of those modules I've actually transmutated from other people's Eurorack modules because I like the sound of them, but they're just too tiny for me.
Yeah.
The little tiny knobs. And, you know, I'm just an old school kind of guy.
The only Eurorack I remember is Dofer. I mean, Dofer innovated it. And then all of a sudden you had these in it, like, kind of hip, semi expensive, $500 to $1,000 third party. And I'm like, you have all these things. If you have a huge paycheck, then you can get them. But it's just at the same time, it's like some people make these $35,000 machines and then just make, you know, the Doom soundtrack to, you know, go boop, 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 boop. And it's like, I think it's funny because it's like, maybe I could just do this on the computer, but some people are diehard about it and want to be avant-garde, you know.
You nailed it. Exactly right. You could do it on the computer, but it's more fun and more challenging to put your hands on actual knobs and, you know, set them up and twirl them. I think there are a lot of guys that just have a lot of money and that's just their dream. They're not really musicians and their dream is to recreate that kind of soundtrack type of sound. And and great, go for it. You know, I say that's awesome, you know. And there's a lot of guys that do synthesizer stuff for a little while and then they needed to pay the rent and they end up selling the entire giant, you know, system they have. You see it all the time.
Oh, I do it too. I sell my instruments then get something else.
And I've done it too. I've bought modules that I thought I was going to love and I didn't end up loving them and I end up selling them or trading them with other guys. And I actually sold some of my modules to finance part of the Girlville album, actually. Mm. There were some modules that I just wasn't using, and I was kind of looking at them thinking, you know, this is kind of like staring cash in the face, basically. So if I'm not using it, I can't justify keeping it. That's kind of my motto.
What have been some of the responses to the Girlville album? I listened to an interview you did on a radio station. Was that an oldie station?
Well, there's been several stations I've done interviews with. Mostly they're kind of retro pop internet stations, but there are some actual real radio stations that play kind of a mix of the old and the newer bands and older bands. And but it's what you call melodic pop, you know, whether that's, you know, something that just came out or something that's from the old days, you know. But the reaction's been good. I've been getting a lot of really nice comments and compliments, which is always nice. You know, I don't do it for that reason. I only do music because I like doing it, and it's fun, and it's challenging, and it makes me happy. And if I was trying to be commercial, I would be writing songs for Beyonce or somebody like that. But I don't want to do that. It's not – that doesn't ring my chimes. So I'm not going to, prostitute myself just for the sake of trying to write something that's in today's flavor. I'm way past that, you know. That doesn't matter to me. When I was 17, I might have tried to have done that, but at this stage, I just do the music that makes me happy. And the girl group thing is something that's very uncommercial, and all of my projects are uncommercial. They're never going to make a lot of money, but artistically, they just make me really happy, and that's my motivation.
And you were saying your era in music was more the late 60s to the 70s. At what point did you really discover that sound from the early 60s?
That's a good question. I moved to L.A. when I was about 20. And I'm from Seattle, and they really didn't have a lot of used record stores in those days. When I moved to L.A., there were record stores galore. And this is pre-internet. I'm talking about 1975 through 79. So I could basically go to a used record store and buy an armload full of albums for like $5 in those days. And I would come back with, you know, all these great albums, including, you know, some of the early Beach Boys things, which I never had really listened to. I was a huge Beatles fan, but I never was a Beach Boys fan until I was probably about 20 or 21 or so. And so I just kind of discovered these different eras of pop, kind of pop rock of the late, I'd say mid to late 60s to early 70s. I kind of lost interest in pop music around the time of the whole new wave, disco and new wave era.
So you're saying you never really got into the 80s new wave sound because a lot of people associate that as kind of the pinnacle of synth.
Oh, I love Italo disco, by the way. All the Italo disco in the 80s is wonderful. It's just, I think it's only in Italy or something. But, you know, it's weird. There's a record store in Philadelphia in the basement. They just sell 50-cent dollar records of Italo disco and, like, weird indie rock and noise. And I remember sometimes just going in that store and just picking up 12 records for, like, $5. And you know it sounds weird, the economy, but it's odd enough to think records 30 years previously, like Italo disco, is no one wants.
Yeah, the nice thing about those days was you could bring all these records home really cheaply, and you could even check them out from the library for free. But now we have the internet and YouTube and all these individual websites, and you can preview things on Amazon. You know, you don't have to take a chance as much. You can pretty much hear what you're going to get. And I like buying stuff through Amazon. I could buy used stuff super cheap, you know, that's in good playable shape. And maybe there's just one song on the album sometimes that I like, and it's, you know, it's worthwhile. But it was fun for me back in the day. I really don't play vinyl that much anymore because I'm either driving and I can't play vinyl then, or I'm working on my own music in my home studio and I don't have time to really play other people's vinyl albums. So I tend to, you know, burn them onto a disc or play them off of my iPhone while I'm in the car, that kind of thing.
Yes, Matt, it's interesting you mentioned vinyl because I heard some comedian talk about, it was funny, he said back in the day, the only way you could decide if a record was good or not is if you looked on the art on the vinyl record.
On look at the art?
Yeah.
That's like books, too.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you'd look at an album and go, well, I'm going to take a chance on this. It looks like it's a cool album. And then you'd bring it back home and play it and go like, ugh, no way, you know. And I've actually bought albums just because of the artwork and didn't even think the music was going to be good. And it turned out the music was cooler than the cover sometimes, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But there's so much out there that you've never heard of. And that was one of the things we did with the magazine was discover genres of music that were totally uncommercial that some record company put out. Maybe they only made like 200 copies of it. And now they're considered like collector's items. You know, I've actually worked on some of these albums, restoring the audio for a couple of record labels in Los Angeles.
Are you still constantly searching for new genres in music? And can you give some examples of the most recent thing that you discovered that really stood out as being unique?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I am always searching for new music that I like that I haven't stumbled into before. I'll tell you one of the areas I used to hate, and that's early country music. I used to think it was super twangy and kind of corny, but we're talking,
about the 50s music.
Yeah, or early 60s like Johnny Cash and Buck Owens and that kind of thing. I kind of like it now, whereas when I was young, I was kind of turned off by it, you know. It's, you know, very old school. It has nothing to do with young country, as they call it today. But there's kind of
country music is almost like it's like country pop now.
It's, you know, it's rock and roll with a twang. That's basically, you know, there's some fiddles or a pedal steel guitar, but it's pretty much rock pop. And it's kind of become kind of computerized with, you know, pitch corrected, you know, singing is like a little too perfect. And that's why I kind of like that early style of, you know, Patsy Cline and, you know, Willie Nelson and these guys. They didn't really sing perfectly, kind of like Bob Dylan, you know. He had a style that was so unusual and kind of ragged that there's a charm to it that you don't really get when you fine-tune all the bugs and mistakes out of it. You lose the charm. It's kind of like you're talking about analog synths, you know. Part of the charm of analog synthesizers is the dirt, the dirt and the imperfections. Maybe the things weren't tuned properly sometimes, you know, but there's a certain charm to that.
Yeah, I understand that feeling. You know, one of my favorite blues musicians is Abner Jay, and he didn't have a perfect voice, but what I loved about his music is that it was so grim. Like, right. He talked about almost starving during the Depression, and there was some real music to me.
Yeah, that's earthiness. Yeah, that's, I'm reading a book right now about Sam Phillips. You know, he's the guy that discovered Elvis, and they recorded, you know, those really early guys like Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins, and there was a real earthiness to that kind of music that's very organic. And I think we kind of lost that in some respects today, you know. And one of the things I learned from working with Jean-Jacques was to try and not make music too perfect. Like, we would go in and move the notes around sometimes to make them a little bit more random sounding, because it's more human sounding that way.
Did it come out the difference, like a subtle kind of a offbeat note, or was it meant to be more kind of explicit and harsh?
No, they're very subtle. Like, you almost wouldn't even notice. It's like when you sing, you know, like most singers don't sing every note completely right on the pitch. But when you go into this pitch correction, auto-tune stuff, it makes it almost robotic, which is kind of boring to me, I mean, personally. So, you know, I've been known to go in and fix a couple of notes here and there, but I always try and do it in a way that you can't detect, where it doesn't sound too fake. I think it's the fake part of it that really I try and avoid. And that's something that I learned, like I said, from my friend Jean-Jacques, who just died last year. He was 87 years old when he passed away. And he was kind of my mentor. He taught me a lot about recording and a lot about electronic music.
And you were saying earlier he was pretty much one of the first electronic musicians. Some of the bands in the 60s, they did use the Moog synth, but it played a minor part, like it was maybe in the background. So he was the first musician to make music where the synth was the key emphasis.
Yeah, he really was. He his music wasn't super popular, but there's a really big cult following of his music. And people find it charming and a little bit childlike at times. But overall, the biggest part of his music was his sense of humor and creativity. He would a lot of times put sound effects of babies crying and dogs barking and things like that. But it always worked in kind of a funny style of electronic music. So a lot of his music was used in commercials. He actually made a really good living doing music that was kind of in the background in commercials. And that's how I discovered his music, actually, was on TV, hearing it in the background. I had to find out, what is that sound?
These were commercials, especially in the 70s?
Mainly in the 60s, but also the 70s, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For major products like, you know, Q-tips and candy bar commercials and motor oil and just all kinds of products. You know, you might not know how it was recorded or who did it, but at the time it was very revolutionary, and the ad agencies were looking for new sounds all the time, and he was on the cutting edge of that. Yeah.
Also, I'm reading Chicken on the Rocks, which you collaborated with Pere. That was used as a theme song for Astro Chicken in Space Quest by Sierra.
I never even knew about that, actually. Send me the link to that, would you? Yeah. Well, you never know. You never know how things are going to get, you know, transmutated and recycled. And, you know, there's a lot of that going on today.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, is there anything you'd like to add about your album, Grillville? And for people in the audience, if they want to check out the album?
Well, it was a great project for me. It was super fun. And the album actually has its own webpage, which is danacountrymansgrillville.com. If you just type in Grillville, you probably find it. And there's sound samples on that webpage where people can listen. They can stream the whole album for free, actually. And there's reviews.
Yeah, so some of the songs are on YouTube, too.
Yeah, I think all of the songs are actually on YouTube. And there's some radio interviews on that website if people want to know more about the album and some of the stations that have been playing it. But it's just been a really rewarding project, and I appreciate you bringing me on the show to talk about that and also all the other things that we talked about today. I've enjoyed the conversation.
You are.
Dana Countryman, I'd like to thank you for being on. It's an excellent show. I'm a big fan of your work.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. And keep up the good work with your show, too.
And also, thanks, Pilliter and Adventure Kid.
Nice. You're welcome. Nice talking to you guys, like always.
Hey, guys. Take care.